Let's get started today. Welcome to our latest Employment Law 101 session. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Peter. I'm a partner in Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We're based in the south of England, but we work with businesses that are all over the world and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that is where we help them out. I am delighted, as ever, to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, everybody. Nice and bright sunny day for a change.
It's a bright sunny day. Adrienne and I were at a client's HR conference the last couple of days, and we had a pretty torrid journey back yesterday in absolutely torrential rain. So it's nice to see the sunshine again and not be so damp this morning. Just a couple of housekeeping matters before we get into today's session. Those of you that are joining live, thank you. Obviously, the big advantage of joining live is you can ask us questions and we'll do our best to answer them as we go along. So please use the Q&A function down at the bottom. If you've got any questions on this topic as we go, we'll try and address them. If you want to chat to any of the other participants, you can do so just using the chat function. But if you specifically want to ask a question, just use the Q&A box down at the bottom, because that is what helps us to manage them. So what are we looking at today? This is actually a listener suggested topic. So one of you got in touch and said, I've been reading all of the headlines about equal pay, including the claim about Next, which I think was the most recent one that hit the headlines. Can you do a session that just covers what's going on there and what we need to be thinking about? So here we are today talking about that. Now, as a business, as employment law advisors, we have thought for some time now that equal pay claims in the private sector are really going to take off. And we're probably seeing that now with the claims that we've got against the large retailers who are in the firing line, to the likes of Next, Asda, Sainsbury's, Morrisons. There are quite a few group action claims involving thousands or tens of thousands of claimants going through the system. But actually, any size of employer can face a claim of this type. And we know this because we've spent time defending smaller businesses against those types of claims. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you're not a Sainsbury's or a Tesco or a Morrisons of this world, you can still be in the firing line for equal pay claims. Equal pay claims are super, super technical. It's a very technical area of the law. And so for that, really read expensive. They're time consuming and expensive to deal with. And they take a lot of time to get through the tribunal system as well, as we'll see in terms of what happened with Next. Because there are various stages that the tribunal has to go through to establish liability. So it's not one of those quick claims. It's not like a bog standard Section 98 unfair dismissal claim, unfortunately. Before we get into the weeds of actually how the Next case operates, here's a very quick refresher just how the law of equal pay operates. Now, bear in mind, this is a massive, massive topic. I mean, Adrienne and I could sit here and talk to you for probably 7 hours about equal pay, which I'm not sure any of us would find the most interesting, but it is such a broad topic. There's so many facets to it. And it is a very interesting topic, I think, when you drill down into it. But in terms of trying to summarize in about 90 seconds what equal pay involves, these are the headlines. So first of all, we obviously have a principle of equal pay. That's covered in the Equality Act 2010. That actually consolidated stuff that was in the Equal Pay Act all those years ago in the 70s. So we're talking about the Equality Act as a bit of legislation. And the basic principle, uncontroversial, is that men and women should receive equal pay for equal work. Now, in the legislation, it's actually referred to as equality of terms, but colloquially, people still refer to it as equal pay. That's what we'll call it. In terms of equal work, what it means is that anybody who's employed under a contract to do work is entitled to contractual terms that are as favourable as those of a comparator that's in the same employment and where the comparator is of the other gender. And when we're talking about same work, equal work, we're talking about three things there. We're talking about like work, which is broadly similar jobs that people are doing. We're talking about work that's rated as equivalent. Now, that might be rated through some type of job evaluation study. which rates males and females being at the same rating. Now, historically, job evaluation studies, if anybody joining today is from a public sector background, that's where they were predominantly used. But we are seeing more and more private sector clients actually using job evaluation studies as a means of setting pay grades. The third category is work of equal value. So what we're talking about there is not the same job. So a female and male comparator, they're not doing the same job, but their two jobs have the same demands on them. And it's the same demands with reference to things like the skill needed to do the job, the amount of effort that needs to go into doing the job, and the decision-making process when deciding things in relation to that job function as well. So that's what we're talking about in terms of work of equal value. So how does the law achieve this? Well, what it does is it implies a sex equality clause into everybody's contract of employment, and it operates to replace any less favorable terms with the equivalent more favorable terms of a man's contract. So it's implied in every employee's employment contract. Now, that clause that's implied doesn't operate if an employer can show that there is a difference in contractual terms due to what's called a material factor. So they have a material factor, a reason why there is a difference in the terms that apply. And that material factor needs to be neither directly or indirectly discriminatory on the grounds of sex. So bear in mind, if you have a factor that on the face of it looks like it's gender neutral, but in the application of that factor, it has a disproportionate impact on women, for example, it would need to be objectively justified by the employer. So there is a justification element to it. So essentially, equal pay claims are just types of sex discrimination claims. What about the claims process itself?
It's complicated, and obviously, it depends on the type of equal pay claim being brought. But they're usually brought in the tribunal. Sometimes they can be brought in the civil courts. But in terms of what a tribunal will look like and what the outcome might be, certainly for things like equal value claims, there's a very set procedure where the claims are brought in the tribunal involving expert reports, etc., and all the rest of it. But the outcome is that the tribunal will make a declaration of the claimant's rights and require payment of any arrears of pay, which is what we'll come on to when we talk about the next case, or it can be damages for breach of a non-pay term, for example, if that's the term that's in question. So, I mean, look, coming on to the facts of the next claim, I'm sure most of you have probably read about it in the press anyway. But a group of sort of roughly 3,500 claimants brought claims for equal pay against Next, female floor sales workers who alleged that Next had breached this equal pay provisions of the Equality Act by paying them less than the warehouse staff, who were predominantly male. I think it's worth saying at this point that while most of the time the reported cases are underpaid female workers versus higher paid males, there is nothing to say that it can't be the other way around. So, it's worthwhile just remembering that. But, in this one, we're talking about women who are paid less than men. But the claimant's allegations were really quite complicated, weren't they? Because they weren't just relating to an hourly rate of pay. There were 17 different contractual terms giving effect to the difference in pay. And what the decision that came out recently followed an earlier decision last year, in June 2023, where an employment tribunal had already decided that the claimants were carrying out work of equal value to the work carried out by the warehouse staff. So it's and I think this is the thing to remember with equal pay cases. They very often go in stages. So, sometimes you see cases which are won on the first point but will lose on the next point. And so what happened in May this year was a hearing to determine whether Next could establish the material factor defence that Peter was just talking about in relation to the contractual terms. So the tribunal decided that Next couldn't establish the material factor defence in relation to seven of those 17 contractual terms, including the principal term relating to basic pay. And that meant that the claimant's equal pay claims in respect of those terms was successful. Next was able to establish the material factor defence in relation to the other contractual terms, and that meant that those claims on those parts failed.
Yeah, I mean that's relevant because it wasn't just one sole payment or contractual term that the claimants were saying, hey, there's a breach here. They were throwing quite a lot at NEXT. So I think 17, you said, of which a whole bunch of them didn't succeed because there was a material factor. So the next thing that the tribunal looked at was the material factors that NEXT were trying to rely on, essentially. So bear in mind, I said that what NEXT were able to do is what any employer is able to do is say, hey, we've got a material factor here. So there's a good reason as to why there's a pay disparity. And then it's up to the tribunal to consider, well, is that material factor directly discriminatory against one gender, or is it indirectly discriminatory? So when we look at what NEXT was saying in terms of their defense, they said, well, and this is one thing that we hear all of the time in terms of justification of pay practices. They said market forces and market price dictate. So that was one of them. Second one was, hey, we have difficulty recruiting and sustaining sufficient warehouse labor. So that justifies disparity in pay between warehouse staff and between shop floor workers within stores. And then the third reason or silo of reasons came down to viability, business resilience, performance of the NEXT group and various subsidiaries as well. So a lot of probably cost and profitability type factors as well, I think. Let's be clear. The tribunal said there was no direct discrimination. So they said it isn't the case that NEXT have decided to pay men more than women. You know, that conscious decision-making process hadn't been gone through. The warehouse and the sales teams that are on the shop floor each had male and female workers in there. It wasn't like all of the warehouse workers were male, all of the shop floor workers were female. And all of the warehouse staff got the same pay, didn't matter what their gender was. All of the sales staff in the shop floor, they also got the same pay as well. And again, it didn't matter what their gender was. There wasn't any evidence either that anybody making the pay decisions were motivated by sex in any way. The reason for the difference in pay was cost, and gender didn't actually enter into the equation. So, you know, you then think, well, how have NEXT actually tripped up here? And it's because the tribunal have gone on to consider, well, were the material factors NEXT relied on indirectly discriminatory? And that's where it gets interesting. So you look at the statistics, and it said that paying warehouse staff more than the sales staff had a disproportionate effect on women. And the reason for that is simple. During the period of assessment that the tribunal were looking at, sales staff were 77.5% female. Warehouse staff were 52% male. So there's an imbalance there. And it was also significant that NEXT had been benchmarking against the market as well. And we'll talk about that in a moment, why that is significant. But the labour market had an imbalance, and that imbalance was favouring male workers. So you've got a predominantly male warehouse. You've got an imbalance in the labour market favouring males. And the higher rate of pay reflected that imbalance. And that's where you get the discrimination.
And pick there as well, because I think one of the questions we often get asked is there still risk of equal pay claims where you've got, say, a female worker in a store, and they can point, you know, the company can point to a female worker in the warehouse and say, well, you know, the women in the warehouse are paid the same as the men, so how can there be this differential? And it doesn't really matter if there was one, say, male worker in the warehouse being paid more, just one out of everybody in the warehouse, and the female store staff were being paid less, that claim would still be successful, even if, you know, the company kind of follows on from what you were saying, there's no intention to directly discriminate on the grounds of sex, but that's how equal pay works. They pick that comparator and there need be only one. And I think that's something that's quite important to remember. I get asked that question quite a lot.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So just looking at whether or not there was the pay differential was objectively justified. This is all the terminology that we see around indirect sex discrimination. Mm-hmm. So if we remember what we have in there, it's, you know, what's the legitimate business aim that the company is trying to achieve? That's the first point. And is what they're doing a proportionate means of achieving it? And that was the next part of the tribunal discussion to look at that. Now, what the tribunal said is that paying warehouse staff more basic pay than sales staff was one way of next achieving the aim, obviously making sure that they could recruit, ensure viability, making sure that they could compete possibly with other warehouses, warehousing operatives. But it wasn't the only way. But it found that Next actually could have afforded to pay a higher rate of pay to its retail staff, but preferred to keep their costs to a minimum. So this was all about profitability and cost, which, as Peter said, is not the whole reason. Cost cutting and cost cutting alone is not enough of a legitimate aim. And that's kind of quite consistent through other employment laws as well. But even if the aim had been legitimate, payment of different sums to warehouse and retail staff is not a proportionate means of achieving it. And the business need wasn't enough to overcome the discriminatory effect, because that's the bit that they need to do. Is it that balance of business justification over the discriminatory effect on staff? And the answer was no. So consequently, Next couldn't establish the material fact to the defence in relation to the difference, and the sex equality clause that's implied into the claimant's contracts was effective to stop them from being paid less than the warehouse staff. Mm. So, and I mean, and that sort of that same thinking, that justification not being enough, was similar across the other contractual terms. So you're looking at shift premiums, rest breaks, long service awards, you know, sort of the other bits that the warehouse staff got, which the retail staff didn't.
Yeah. And again, I mean, that's obviously related to this point that, remember, in this case, and what you'll find with equal pay claims, it's probably not just going to be my base salary is X, my comparator's base salary is Y. I think there's a discriminatory reason for that. Claimants may well look to incorporate a whole range of different provisions. And there were 17 different ones in this case. And I just want to run through some of the others because I think they're quite interesting, especially if you're coming from businesses that operate different types of shift premiums and different types of allowances. And especially if you also, I mean, like a few of our clients actually operate a warehousing aspect to your business, a commercial aspect to the business in terms of like head office function or branch network, something like that. You're going to have different types of payments that are made across those different compartments within the organization as a whole. The tribunal found that pay differential was justified in relation to some of the remaining contractual terms. So it was possible they accepted Next's justification for other payments or bonuses that were made to warehouse staff that were not available, or that they were only available at a reduced rate to other sales staff. And some examples of these are: between April and June 2020, Next paid basic pay plus 10% to warehouse staff who came back early from furlough. Cast our minds back to the pandemic days when there were all sorts of incentives like that being made available. Everything was in a bit of a state of flux. So they didn't get enough volunteers for people to come back from furlough. So they incentivized. The tribunal found that those payments were a legitimate means of incentivizing staff to return, and there wasn't a realistic way of otherwise achieving that. So, you know, Next have made that argument and the tribunal has said, yes, we accept it. Another example is that in late 2020, warehouse staff were paid an extra £1 for every hour that they worked. And that was because they were adrift from the market in terms of basic pay with relevance to a local competitor. And, you know, we know the reality is, oh, if you're operating a business, you've got local competition. Naturally, you're going to be benchmarking your pay against what a competitor does locally, because, you know, you don't want to be bleeding decent employees to a competitor. It gives you a massive disadvantage. Again, the tribunal said that was a proportionate way of incentivizing retention during, you know, a competitive labor situation where there was maybe a limited talent pool of people locally. Next wanted to keep hold of its stable workforce. Understandable. A couple of others: there was £1,000 bonus paid to warehouse staff if they attended in January 2022. And again, that was justified to prevent warehouse staff leaving after the same competitor advertised a £1,500 joining bonus, get this, on a van parked outside Next's warehouse. So cheeky. You got this, the competitor driving up with their van saying, hey, come and work for us, get this £1,500 sign-on bonus. So Next have taken a commercial, pragmatic, practical step of addressing that and paying £1,000 to their warehouse staff. Cynically, do you reckon any of the Next employees arranged for that van to turn up and pay for
I
it?
don't
I'm just
know.
joking, it's not a judgment. And then finally, some of the warehouse staff were paid triple pay on public holidays. Now, that compares to just time and a half rate offered to sales staff. But again, there was an objective justification for that difference. And that was because warehouses operated around the clock, so 24/7 operation. And that wasn't the same for stores. Obviously, they had store opening times. So without that triple pay, Next said, and the tribunal accepted, they had difficulties trying to find enough warehouse staff to actually cover and resource the shift on public holidays. So, you know, that just highlights that there are, you know, the tribunals will listen to the arguments. There are sound commercial reasons that can be advanced, but you need to do the groundwork in terms of setting out. And I think if you're in a position of thinking about things like, how are we going to incentivize our staff this year? What are we doing to head off local competition? What are we doing about signing bonuses? What are we doing about shift premiums? It's working through that rationale in advance of the payment to make sure that there are justifications you can fall back on, which apply to those particular subset of employees. And you don't get caught out by somebody sitting elsewhere within your organization saying, hang on a moment, I'm not getting that same incentive. Therefore, I think there's some sort of discrimination going on here.
Yeah, and I think that's, and this is, comes back to the point about it being a several stage process. So you get over the first hurdle of whether the work is equal value, but then it's looking at all of this stuff. So the business reasons are absolutely critical, as is evidence. I mean, I can just see retail staff coming up and saying, well, actually, do you know what? There's the recruitment on the high street is really difficult as well to retain and keep staff. And, you know, there's many jobs that are unfilled, particularly post Brexit. So, you know, maybe that's one of the arguments that the claimants might come up with in another case and say, hey, look, here's all the evidence of retail jobs available. Why aren't the same incentives being provided to us to keep us? And then, you know, and it's looking at all of that stuff in terms of your business and keeping the evidence and making sure that what these decisions aren't just made for historic reasons. But I mean, I think an awful lot of a long way to go. Next, we're obviously facing a quite a large bill of 30, I think, is it 30, 35 million quid in terms of back
pay?
Yeah,
estimates 30 million.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a massive amount. And obviously, unsurprisingly, said they're going to appeal the judgment. And it'll be quite interesting, based on what the tribunals found, that they're basically their material factor wasn't enough, to see where that will go. But I think the problem with a lot of these equal value claims, having done a bit of reading, is that they are so fact specific. Because when you're looking at one business's reasons, you know, what your justification is, it may well be that that's completely different from another. And that's why, you know, as a business, when you're facing this type of assessment, yes, you can have a look at what cases are out there and what decisions have been made, but fundamentally it's going to be very fact specific to you. But yeah, I mean, there's I think if you go onto the internet and Google all of this stuff, there's a load of places out there which are saying, you know, are you an Asda worker? Are you a Tesco's worker? And here's a button to join the claim. In where it's on various lawyers that are handling the claims. So I think it is going to be massive for sure. But yeah, I mean,
had an advert pop up on YouTube or somewhere, really random.
Oh, really?
The algorithm thinks that I work at Sainsbury's.
Because you were looking at all the sort of all the ramifications of these
claims.
Yeah,
maybe so. It's like, hello, have you got an interest in this? Do you want to bring a claim? A bit like the diesel emissions claims as well, but they're trying to group together employees, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think about one of the biggest things that's come out of this is talking about market rates, market forces, what other people are paying, the sort of like historic reasons. That's not going to be enough. That's not going to be enough to be able to defend the claims. And, you know, I was told when we were talking yesterday in a completely different context, we were talking about baked in discrimination and the risk that is posed of baked in discrimination when you look at things like AI. You know, AI scrapes data that's already there historically. AI just adds another level of discrimination potentially over the top. And I think it's a similar thing here that, you know, historically, men in the warehouse have been paid more because it's deemed to be that type of job. And market forces as your defense to it is another layer of discrimination that's you know, overlaid what's already there. So I think that's where tribunals are trying to unpick that. So that's just my view anyway.
Well, it's, I mean, you know, it's what we're saying as commentators, it perpetuates discriminatory effect, because you don't have to go too far back in history where warehousing was deemed to be a man's job, inverted commas, and working in a shop was a woman's job. And that was before, you know, one of the drivers for bringing in the Equal Pay Act. And obviously, it's, you know, now it's just not reflective of modern society at all. But the problem is, if you're using incorrect or deficient benchmarking data, which, you know, perpetuates a higher rate of pay for warehouse workers, then you're never going to get out of this cycle, are you?
No.
And that's where you can get unstuck. And that's why the relevance of all of this for a lot of you that are listening to this, listening live, listening on our podcast, is that the benchmarking data, it has got to be accurate. But if you're just relying on a more vague woolly argument of market forces, you need to be able to back that up. Because if you're challenged on it, you know, tribunals will drill down, won't they?
Yeah, absolutely. They're not just going to take it at face value. You're not going to go, "Oh, right, some material forces. Look at this, look at that. They're going to unpick, well, how have those market forces, how's that market data being arrived at? Is there this sort of like systemic discrimination behind it? So, yeah, it is really important to make sure that you've got the evidence, which that, you know, they did have in relation to the examples that you gave, and they could demonstrate that they had a good business reason, and that what they did was done to achieve that that aim.
Yeah. So the tribunals there, that's why they reached a different view, because they said, well, actually, whether it's these temporary payments, those one-off payments sort of in relation to the pandemic, in relation to fighting off local competition, they were in response to fluctuating market pressures at certain moments in time. And it's perfectly justifiable to run that as well. But one of the key takeaways of this judgment as well is really this emphasis on there's got to be more of a compelling business reason than cost cutting alone to justify lower pay in certain sectors, because of the indirect effect of doing that. Now, that isn't a new point, but it's just a reminder that you can't really rely on that. You've got to show that saving money isn't the sole aim of keeping salaries low. There needs to be some other reason for that. Before we wrap up, we've got just a couple of questions. One question. One's just a comment. Thank you for that. Hello, Elaine. Can long service payments be deemed unfair? I mean, in the context of equal pay, they could be, depending on how the arrangements actually work in practice. So, you know, in an example of warehouse versus branch network, if long service payments were only ever paid to warehouse employees and there was a disproportionate number of males versus females working in the warehouse, then you can see how it would form the basis of an argument if it's contractual term.
Also, don't forget, it's even more nuanced than that, because it could be that warehouses get long service awards after five years and people in stores get it after 10 years. So there's little strands of inequality that can go all the way through it, not just one gets it, one doesn't, but what are the criteria that are applied. So it's making sure that there's some consistency there. But if you want to be inconsistent, coming back to what we talked about just now, do you have the evidence to support the reason why you're doing it?
Yeah, perfect. We're coming in just on time, which is amazing for us. So thanks for everyone joining us. Just a reminder, we've got, I think, about 52. This might be episode 53 podcasts now. So have a look on Spotify, on Amazon Music, to search up Employment Law 101. You'll find loads of relevant employment law content on there. The video for this session, along with all of the previous sessions, goes onto our website, NPM Legal. You can follow Adrian and I on LinkedIn as well. So feel free to follow or connect with us on there. We're going to be back in 2 weeks' time. We're back in the two-weekly schedule. So 2 weeks' time, we're actually teaming up with our diversity and inclusion consultancy, NPM included. So 2 weeks today, same time, 11 o'clock, we're going to be doing a session in relation to diversity and inclusion in the workforce with NPM included and guest speaker Sarah Wilder from included. So look out for the invites from us for that. In the meantime, always welcome feedback. Drop us a line. Today's session was entirely motivated by somebody who wanted us to cover it. So drop us a line if there's anything you'd like us to cover off. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of your week and we'll see you next time. Cheerio.